Welcome to episode 8 of B2B, the Business Club podcast. I'm very lucky today to have a guest with us, PJ Ellis, legal professional, reality TV star, philanthropist, entrepreneur.
Entrepreneur, yeah.
And that broadcaster.
apparently.
So a lot to get through in regards to what you've done, what you're doing, what you're going to do. So would you please start us off? For those that have been living under a rock, by just giving us an introduction to who you are.
Oh, thanks, guys. That was a nice introduction, to be fair. I think it's sometimes quite, not difficult, but it's weird that there are so many sort of, what's the word? Is it an adjective? Is it a, I don't worry, whatever it is, but there's so many words around what I do. I sometimes find it difficult to tell people what I do because I do so much. And sometimes I think that frustrates me a little bit, you know, when I'm feeling a bit sort of not lost or down. I'm starting to think, have I carved out a proper career in my life, you know? But what I've realised is my career, my life, certainly hasn't been linear, you know. I could have easily stayed in law for 20 odd years, 30 years. And sometimes I think, you know, am I going to regret that one day? And actually, when I do think about it, I don't think about it that often, but when I do think about it, I'm actually quite proud of the things that I've been able to do. And, you know, I would encourage people to sort of explore different sort of pathways and avenues because it's brought to me so many different people and experiences and learns and lessons. And because of that, I'm grateful. So, yeah, I fell into law, if I'm completely honest, about 6 to 7 stone ago. I always thought I'd be a footballer. You know, you get one guy tell you over the park, you know, great goalkeeper you are, mate.
You're decent, though, mate.
I was decent. Thanks, Kev. You were right as well.
You were watching, mate.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure. Rainer, weren't
you? You've bagged a few goals past me, haven't you, mate? And we played together, obviously, and you, Chris. But yeah, I just always thought I'd be going to be a footballer. And then, yeah, I mean, law just came off the back of my grades. It was as simple as that. I was quite a socially awkward kid. I still am a little bit. This is a bit of a bravado that I've got from the reality TV sort of experience. And my refuge, if that's the right word, was very much the library. You know, I wasn't bullied as much as I was because I was a decent footballer. And then when I weren't really hanging out in those groups because we weren't playing football, I'd just run off to the library. So I got good grades and my career advisor was very much like to be a lawyer. But that was based off, I don't know what careers advice you guys got, but genuinely the guy in front of me, do you remember, they ask you questions, don't they? Sort of, do you want to work outside? You know, all that. I can't remember what I answered. And the guy in front of me got a scuba diver. You can become
a scuba diver.
I don't know. Can't even remember his name, to be fair, but it was a school in Chelmsley Woods, landlocked. You know, don't know where you'd dive.
In Chelsea swimming baths now, is
all it? All doing those decks.
You're right.
Yeah, just loving it. The irony was, I always loved, what was that army guy called? What was his name growing up? He had like a buzz, G.I. Joe, was it, or something?
Yeah.
I can't remember what he was.
Yeah.
There was a diver, and I was obsessed with that kid. So anyway, when he got that, I was like, well, not for that. And she was like, I want you to be a lawyer. So I fell into law.
It was either lawyer or scuba
diver. Simple as that. Went back to mum and dad. Mum and dad said, lawyer, probably better, probably more suitable. More money in it.
Better pension.
And if I'm completely honest, I've had like body dysmorphia for most of my life. I wasn't too sure, like the suit would compliment my little legs.
The buoyancy finisher.
I wouldn't need a kit, mate. The head would keep me afloat quite easily. And the bum would balance it out somewhat. So, yeah, but it's been a very, what's the word, as I said, non-linear approach to life. And I wouldn't change much of it, to be fair. Yeah, I'm really proud of the stuff that I've done.
Okay. I'm just diving in a little bit.
Scuba diving.
No, not about scuba diving, but something that resonates with me, what you say sometimes, is about that imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
And I think you just touched upon it there, is that...
Yeah.
sometimes you're just kind of like, I'm a similar thing. I'm a jack of all trades, master of none to a certain extent. And you're kind of like,
But who made that up? You know, who came up with that to be a master of one thing? You know, I think the life that we lead at the moment, certainly in the world that we live in, it requires so many different sort of confidences and nuances in how you talk to people, deal with people, because everyone's going through their different journeys and challenges and whatever it might be. And I think I'm getting better at understanding that this imposter syndrome is just me. It might be a bit of a defense mechanism. You know, I'm not very good at putting yourself out there sometimes. Mm-hmm. But the irony is, as I'm sure you've experienced, once you do, well, maybe the word isn't irony, but once you do get over that sort of threshold where you start thinking, actually, no one really cares as much as you think they do, you actually start getting applauded for the things that you can do. And you start thinking, actually, I can do a lot of good things. And I suspect, you know, this sort of like dotting around, looking at opportunities has been part of that, where I've been trying to lean into things that make me more comfortable than others. And in doing that, I've started to do loads of different things. But yeah, I'm getting a lot better at my imposter syndrome. And the way I'm getting better, I know about you, Kirby, is I'm just trying to look at things in a more of a binary way. That's how I'm talk to my kids, that, you know, if you want to go on television, right, you either do it or at least try it, one, or zero, you don't, and you never will. I know that seems really simple, but I'm starting to better understand that actually there's loads of opportunities out there. And just because you might think you're not good enough, if you have got the belief that you are good enough and you then try to do it, sometimes brilliant things happen.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, it's quite an exciting way of looking at things, because there's so many brilliant opportunities out there. And if you stay behind this sort of imposter syndrome that most people have, you never get to experience any of those things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I suspect loads of people have those feelings.
And you're going, so you're going into law or doing this, and obviously great opportunity once you're a big brother, and it opened up a lot of doors, I'd imagine, which we'll come on to.
Yeah.
Then you, once you've tasted the excitement, then you probably want to be excited every day by your job, and obviously moving on to the things you're doing now, that you're constantly going out and being like, this is good.
You know, I don't think I've ever unpacked Big Brother as much as I probably should have, because I would say to everyone now that I never wanted to be famous. Big Brother was very much like, you know, back then it was, you know, you couldn't talk about the things that you might be able to do off the back of it. It was a, you know, a social experiment with a capital S. I mean, there's no way I'd get into those shows now, because I'm probably too normal, sort of thing. You know, I'm not ripped out of my brains. Like, you know, I haven't got millions of followers on Instagram. I'm not saying it's all those people that do these reality TV shows, but more often than not, there's something going on there that I certainly couldn't offer. So when I did go into Big Brother, I think you're right. I think when I came out, I got this sort of understanding or sense that, wow, this world's a completely different place to what I've been used to. And there's loads of different like things that I could go into that would excite me. And maybe that was me chasing trying to replicate that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I set a business up here, you know, the music wedding videos, I'll try that. But all these little things that it was like a magpie sort of thing. These nice little bright, shiny things. I think initially may have been that, me trying to replace that. I mean, I lived 3 years of like, I had a small look as to what it might be like to be a professional footballer. It was that mad back then. It was crazy, like how, you know, people follow me around. It was just mental. And I suppose, yeah, you're right. I think maybe that's something that I've never really unpacked so like as much as I should. Probably because I just end up crying and that, and have to have like a week off work. It's a massive thing to do as a 21-year-old, you know.
I was going to say, yeah. So if we dial that back then.
Yeah.
So you went from overnight being, were you a trainee solicitor then?
Yeah, I was at law school at the time. Yeah.
Law school.
Yeah.
So you went from literally, and I know from speaking to other people, apparently you were meant to be playing football on the Saturday or the Sunday.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You were meant to be playing on the weekend, but then all of a sudden on Friday night, your friends are seeing you walk into the big brother house.
I had a date on the Friday night. It sounds really bad, yeah, but I had a date on a Friday night and I forgot to cancel it. And she, like, was screwing.
That was your excuse?
It was legit. I mean, back then, I'm not even sure I would have had a mobile phone, but it was like 10p a text. You know, come on. I wasn't working. Yeah, so I was at law school, and the Big Brother thing, it's a bit of smug there at the start, because I'm almost certain that a mate of mine's mum applied for me. She was obsessed with Big Brother, obsessed. Like,
what series was that at that point?
Big Brother 3. No, so she would have been watching Big Brother 1 or 2, whatever.
So you were in the first series?
Yeah, the best one, yeah. That one.
The most notorious series.
Most popular. Notorious, the good way.
Yeah,
very good.
The best. No, well, there's, again, it's something like that. There's no such publicity as bad publicity. So that was Nasty Nick and things like that, wasn't it? It was the most recognised, but people look back now pretty much every facet of it.
Yeah, well, Nasty Nick was Big Brother 1, I think, or 2, but you started getting characters like pop up in these sort of like. And it was
a bit of panto. Yeah.
Yes, he was. He was playing a part. And, you know, I think this was, you've got to try and remember, this was like, if you look at it now, it looked like it was filmed in the 60s, 70s. It was so basic. But it was massively, like, new, revolutionary in this reality TV. I'd already had a taste of reality TV because I was on The Villa. Do you remember The Villa?
Yeah.
Which was a matchmaking sort of thing. It was Joe Mangle from Neighbours who used to narrate it.
Is that Sky One?
Yeah, Sky One. Mm-hmm. So there must have been this sort of, like, inkling or desire for me to be famous. But I never went on Big Brother to be famous because it wasn't that platform to be famous, and I couldn't do anything. I couldn't sing, I couldn't dance, I couldn't act, and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, so I was at law school. I'd applied whenever. You had to do a video. That video is still online somewhere. Yeah, I looked like a dusty light bulb man, and shaved my hair. It was just like two bits of like hair here, like the Dungeon Master.
I would have applied last year, but I had sort of a girlfriend, so she wasn't very keen on that. So I've had to dump her. Poor sod. So that's why I'm applying now. Big Brother. The reasons why I want to get onto it, obviously, I wouldn't mind the 70 grand or whatever it is to win. But also, I've got this bet with my mates. I don't probably look like it to you. I probably look more like a kebab shop owner or something. But apparently, I seem to do all right with the women. Well, in fact, I do. So I've always said to my mates that if I was ever sort of famous and I could get into the Met bar for one night, that I could probably get off with a celebrity. Now, that hasn't actually sort of happened at the moment, being so I'm still at law school, so I haven't had much chance to get down the Met bar. But I presume that after my big, you know, impending fame of Big Brother, that I'll be able to go there every Friday, you know, probably meet Natalie and Brugler, something like that, and basically prove my mates wrong.
Brilliant, Dan. I was like... Yeah, I'm PJ. I'm going to go in the house because I want to get off with Natalie and Brulia.
Oh, my God. I remember that.
You look back here, the sun went in on me hard. PJ thinks he wants to get off with Natalie and Brulia. Come on, trying to be funny. And then they just kept inviting me. And going back to this imposter syndrome thing, I think I was so nervous to, you know, I sent off the video thinking nothing of it. You know, hundreds, I think it was 150,000 people applied. And I thought, nah, nothing's going to happen. But when they invited me to go to the first sort of audition, I suppose, I nearly didn't go. You know, it was just like, oh, I'm on my own now. It's one of the moments where you think your dad's going to drop you off and you have to go into the interview on your own. It was just like, that is something I wasn't good at. But then I sort of dialed into this sort of character. I thought, actually, maybe if I act like someone I'm not, it might be easier for me to do that. So when Dad dropped me off, genuinely the queue, it was at the Ibis Hotel in Brindley Place. No, not Brindley Place, the other one, Arcadia. And the queue, it was like X Factor queue, massive, massive. And I thought, right, how can I do something here that might sort of leave a mark? So I just went straight up to the front of the queue and I said, oh, hi, I'm here for the Big Brother auditions. And the guy was like, yeah, so are they. I was like, no, they've told me to come straight to the front, like, you know, blag them a little bit. And he let me in. Now, with hindsight, which is a wonderful thing, what I thought would have happened, i.e. people may have even been in that queue or in the crowd when you go in, have a little scout, see how people respond to one another for the first time. There were. So that really helped me playing that part. So I saw this guy who was full of confidence, when in fact I was just an absolute nervous wreck. And every time they invited me back, so it was a whole day thing, people were whittled away. And then it was less than 10 people at the end of the day. And actually, Lee, who also got into the show, was there on that very day. And we struck up a bit of a partnership. But I was lucky, if that's the right word, that then they would have every audition in like psychometric tests, assessment days, whatever it might be, landed on the day that I didn't have law school. So every Tuesday, I'd be waiting there in like, I don't know, some lesson with my phone off, like that. And they're just almost willing it to phone. Manifestation, maybe, I don't know. And it used to phone. She'd pick me up, well, they'd pick me up, take me down, whatever, and I'd have the best time. They'd put you in a hotel saying, no one else would be brothers in this hotel. Like, loads of young people at the bar, like there are. Get you 20 quid expenses, have a few beers. So it's a real good experience. Talked to some people that have done Big Brother more recently, and it started to become less and less of a social experiment. That time that they put into seeing who would get on with each other, who would clash, who might fancy one another, didn't happen as much. So, you know, I know people that were like asked on Big Brother with no real audition, but it took me literally, there was about 16 stages, right to the point where the producers from Endemol came up to Birmingham and took me and a few mates, my mum and dad, out into Birmingham to see how we'd interact with people. It was mad. Great experience.
Right.
Actually, really good experience, regardless of whether I'd get on or not.
Yeah.
And then when they asked me to get on, wow, I remember the journey. Like, we'd just dropped my brother Tom to the station, me and my dad. And Phil Edgar Jones, the head boy at Endemol, phoned me. My dad had this car phone, genuinely, it's about that big, right? That's having an aerial through the roof almost. It was like, boop, massive. But we were like, we were buzzing with it because it was like one of those yuppie ones that, and I'm sure you had to pay to receive calls. It was that, you know what I mean? It's that early on.
Trade your car battery.
Yeah, you had to pull over, plug yourself in to the grid. Yeah, he just phoned me and said, look, PJ, we want you to be, you're the first person we're calling. We want you to get in there, be in the show. You've had a letter by then whether you're going to be, you're in the last 24, you're either a housemate or a standby. And I looked at my dad and I said, can I call you back, Phil? I may have sweared, I did swear. And in the Big Brother book, he tells you what word I said. I won't repeat it, but I didn't swear. I was shocked. And then my dad said to me, he said, please, look, he said, I've not got involved with this. Me and your mum won't either. It's just all about you being happy. But don't ever have a what-if moment. And that's always stuck with me. Because genuinely, regardless of what I may or may not have done in the house and the experience I've had since, I would always have had a what-if moment if I'd not done it. And I think the pain and the intrigue and that anxiety around that compared to the experience I've got out of Big Brother, they don't compare. This would have been horrendous to have around your neck, whereas this has just afforded me so many different opportunities. I've met some brilliant people. You know, most of the kids we were playing at Showboat were through Big Brother. There's only so many people I still stay in touch with that I went to school with. So yeah, I mean, the lesson of that maybe is just lean into all these opportunities if you are given them. If you're not hurting anyone, you're not being naughty or whatever, just
well, the irony of you having that facade and going to the front of the queue and being all like, yeah, probably not what we knew of you,
yeah, yeah,
is that your nature and your how outgoing you were in the house then showed how real you were, and I think that got you through, didn't it?
Yeah.
Because you can't, I suppose in the house then, 24/7, you can't keep up that,
yeah,
facade of being like, oh yeah, I'm, yeah, a comfort, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
Seeing you real.
I think some of the feedback was from the people that put me in the show, when they started to see me, was that actually, oh, you're not as much of an alpha male as we thought you were. I mean, that was twofold. One, because I was probably being more of myself, which back then certainly was a lot quieter than I can be now. And also, you had big alpha males in that, like Johnny, the firefighter, Alex, Spencer, Lee, Sandy, when you get the geezer that escaped. They were big alpha males, and I was just like, the experience, I mean, I could talk to you all day about that experience in the house, but it was life-changing, it really was, because, you know, nuts and bolts it all was you'd get in there for the first 3 days, and you'd talk to somebody that you'd not known as you would normally, you know, what you do, you know, tell me a bit more about your family, who do you support? And then after that, about 3-4 days, you've got nothing to go at because you weren't getting any stimuli or something coming in, no news, no football results. Oh, I see the Blues last night. None of that. And then because of that, you start becoming really like almost, it's all within them. You start talking to yourself, you start asking yourself questions that you never would have asked outside of the house. And that was quite cathartic for me because I started, it was probably the, you know, you're 21, how many 21-year-olds sitting there having those conversations, back then especially. And it was, yeah, it was a real quite emotional time for me because I started questioning what I really wanted to do. I mean, didn't listen to any of it. So I did ask the questions. But yeah, great experience. Would I tell my son to do Big Brother now? Probably not.
Well, yeah. Like you touched on earlier, though, isn't it? It's a different beast entirely, isn't it, now?
Yeah.
The scouted out, aren't they? Influencers, yeah, etc. are scouted out and invited, aren't they? Rather than,
yeah,
say, the golden Willy Wonka ticket, which it was at the time.
It's not standing on the shoulders of giants, isn't it? That they see what you've got from it,
yeah,
so they're automatically in that zone of, yeah, well, that's what I want from it. Whereas, yeah, you guys, when it was social, isn't it? This experiment, you didn't know what was going to come out of it. Could have turned the cameras off, couldn't they? And you could be just sitting there.
Yeah, 100%. It could have been an absolute scam.
Even with all the work that went into it pre-broadcast with the actual producers, did you have any idea at all? Did you have any idea of the size and scale of what it?
No. Genuinely, the only sort of genuinely, we had no contact. You were allowed to talk to a doctor, both medicinal and psychological, if you had issues. They weren't even going to let me take my shaver in at one point. And I was like, look, can't be a dusty light bulb. We've got to shave it every day. I know, Vicky, you know. So there was no touch with the world other than you could say three things. One, I wanted to know if anyone died in my family. Two, I was joining a big London law firm at that time. I'd got a job to go to and I wanted them to call me if they thought my career was being jeopardised. It never really was going to because I wasn't governed by any codes of conduct as a lawyer at that time because I wasn't a lawyer. And I can't remember the other one, maybe World War or something like that. So as long as I didn't hear those, I thought my life was okay. And I wasn't really thinking about how people would perceive me because you get trapped in this weird sort of like, you've got your own sort of microclimate almost. It's a different world, there's no clocks. You're still having these weird and wonderful conversations. And the only time I really had any sort of interaction with anybody other than going to the diary room was when I couldn't sleep very well. I mean, probably tell I haven't slept very well for years. So I'd get up dead early and put the kettle on, like, you know. And I didn't know where Alstree Studios was because they put us up in a hotel in Watford or something. Had to go down there dead early, a lot earlier than we thought, because Jade had been talking about Big Brother and that, and the newspaper got all of it. So we were lived in blackout for 3 days. All the curtains were shut. We opened it once and there was a reporter on the roof trying to take photos. It was crackers. And then they blindfolded us. There was a lot of trust involved. Blindfolded us to the house. So when I went outside in the morning, 6 a.m. or something, bearing in mind, back in them day, you could watch Big Brother 24/7. People were watching me like with like pigeon noises or whatever, or chicken noises or whatever, sleeping.
What were you making those?
That's how I snore, mate. Whatever. Was that chicken? Cough frog? No, one of the two. And yeah, so you can imagine someone's got up for work, put Channel 4, wasn't it? Yeah, and Channel 4 Extra or whatever.
Yeah, E4, I think. E4
Live, that's right, it. Yeah. And he'd see I was in the garden, and he'd go out of his house like, PJ, yeah, give me a bit of abuse. So I used to have a bit of banter with this guy. If he's listening to the podcast, give me a call, because I've never found out who he is.
But,
yeah, he used to have banter with me. Like, the house would call me straight back in. But he called me a few, like, he called me the C word. Yeah, BJ, you know, for alarm.
Nice wake up.
Yeah, cheers, mate. Good morning. Have a nice day at work. It's took me 3 hours to boil this water, mate. Because I was on the poor side, rich and poor side, man. That's like boil water. Took me, make my own fire. They're like next door, like, smoking, having caviar and whatever. But yeah, I didn't even realise that the Alstree Studios is almost built what it was. Within a housing development. So, yeah, you've got no idea. It's just a vacuum, like, of wow. I mean, when you get to school first, like, first time, the smells stay with you, all that, the feeling. I can't explain it other than that. And that's, I'll never be able to replace that again. It was just a weird and wonderful I was there for 60-odd days. What's that? 10 weeks or something? Yeah,
whole summer.
Sorry?
Is it whole summer, wasn't it?
Yeah, I got a cracking tan, to be fair. Missed the World Cup was on in Japan, I think it was at the time.
Where was that? 2002?
Yeah, 2002.
South Korea.
Was it South Korea? There we go, good knowledge. I think we drew to Nigeria in the second game.
Come on, that year. I don't think it's the most memorable World Cup.
Yeah, but yeah, it was great. So yeah, I've done loads of different things, I suppose. Big Brother is up there in relation to, I suppose, one of the more... is it rare? Is that the right word? I don't know. One of those things I've done that I probably won't be able to do many more of. But then I suppose after that, it's Love Bro. Like I've set up businesses, I've sold a few businesses. I mean, they're not going to make Forbes or anything, those like sales, and I'm not going to bugger off to the Bahamas to retire. But you get
no, but again, so as a from a business perspective, for a rounding experience of being a business person, not a lot of people will be involved in mergers and acquisitions, exiting businesses.
Yeah. That's interesting. We got offered to sell. When I say we, I was at Lightbox because I set up a digital marketing company which merged with a larger organisation. Basically, I've known him down the blues, Rob, good guy. In fact, it was at the Birmingham City Breakfast meeting that I met him, actually. Just a bit of context off there, we were talking about that earlier. We got offered to sell the business in lockdown. Really weird. We'd sold this website into a big PR company in London. Can't say much. I still think I'm on a... what's the word?
NDA.
Disclosure thing, yeah. I don't know why, but... anyway, we won the work. We won this website. And basically, you know, I'm probably elaborating a little bit, but he turns up for his kickoff meeting. He's like, surprise, surprise. I was like, what? He's like, we want to buy the business. We don't even need a website. I'm like, what? That's bizarre. but I need... need you to sell your website? I put it into my forecast. He was the, got 25 bits into me. You know, keep the deal. What's the deal for?
I love as long as it's not less than the website.
Yeah, I love my staff. Oh, what was that? Yeah, fine, that's good. And the lawyer in me, you know, Rob was very much like, except LiveUp sort of 15 years ago. He loves, you know, it's his baby. He was like, no, not interested, mate. I was like, come on, let's just have a look under the bonnet. As a lawyer, I wanted to look at what due diligence looked like, you know, how do you prepare a business to sell and all that. And it opened up Rob's eyes a little bit, because when we turned it down, and with hindsight, it's a wonderful thing, we wouldn't have got the money they offered us. It was a big chunk of cash, but a lot of it was an earn-out thing. And the earn-out was in lockdown. I mean, I was crying in the shower most nights, let alone not know what tomorrow looked like.
Mm-hmm.
So with hindsight, we would not have got the money that we were offered. So I'm glad we turned it down. And I'm glad we turned it down, because Rob then came to me with a little bit of like a new sort of like, what's the word? Energy. You know, he wanted to work in his business forever, but then he started to want to try and sell it. I mean, well, a bit wrong, to be fair, because we brought in big people to do it for us, and they were brilliant people. It just didn't work out for a number of reasons. But yeah, that experience of looking into it and doing it. I mean, at the end of the day, I sold Lightbox back to Rob. It was like a management buyout for nothing. You know, it wasn't the most complex of deals. But even that was interesting and different. And again, another experience. But yeah, so before all that, back 11 years ago now, I was in New York, and I'd started to help out. In fact, I helped set up in a way. I'm not going to take credit for this, far from it. But I was around when the Harry Mosley charity set up. You guys have supported that before. Help Harry, help others. I was absolutely moved by this young boy. I never met him. Just become a dad. You start finding a heart that you never thought you had, don't you? Crying at John Lewis adverts. And I stumbled across this guy on Twitter that was dying. And it sounds terrible, but from morbid fascination, I just followed him. I was intrigued, knowing he was going to pass away. Don't know whether that gave me some perspective or gratitude or whatever it might be, but... I was obsessed to a point. He sold bracelets to celebrities and stuff like that. He was a really inspiring. He changed my life, I think. Inspiring kid.
He's the Mike Horn South, isn't he?
That's right. And then selling with his mom and his family and stuff. It's, you know, still a brilliant charity that goes on today. And I got involved with that. I met his mom, Georgie, and said, look, I want to help. I said I'd put a game of golf on or something for her. And then within a heartbeat, we were selling out the ICC. I think you guys may have, can you?
Yeah.
In fact, that ball still goes on now. It's another proud moment, actually. I set up this Harry Mosley charity ball with a guy called Tim Andrews, who you know has been on your podcast. And I met Tim. How weird is this? Talking about getting out your own way and imposter syndrome. I was stressed out in my mind doing this ball, because he went from, I'll get a couple of prawn sandwiches and take people down Matt Stoke for a game of golf, to, we've got this black tie event at ICC. We've got to get 1,200 people there. And I was stressed. Like, me and the missus, we were, you know, passing ships in the night. I was in a job I hated as a lawyer. I was stressed, coming home, eating probably too much, and then working until 3 a.m. on this ball. So I put on Facebook, can anyone help me? And Tim replied, that's the way he is. He's a very helpful guy. And that next morning, I was supposed to meet him. He had a yacht, he had this big business, Hollywood monster. And I nearly didn't go. I was so nervous to meet him. And look what wouldn't have happened if I hadn't gone with him. And I got a fish figure sandwich out of him as well. He reckons he paid, he didn't. But hey ho. He looked after me after that for years. So I'm not going to do him over a fish finger sandwich. So when I met him, it was we'd done Harry Moser for 2 years. We'd done this 77 challenge where we went on a bike from Switzerland all the way back to Birmingham. We raised like 350 grand there for kids with cancer. We'd raised about another 200 grand with the ball. And I was hooked, like, raising money. I thought, at last, I can find something that I can... enables me to... I felt like the big brother in that opportunity I got was something... I was never able to say thank you for, you know. I felt really privileged to be able to do something like that, and I felt really quite humbled around how Birmingham had been really nice to me, and whether that be within careers, friendships, whatever. And I thought this would be a great way to say thank you by helping charities that are local to me. So we've done that, and then me and my wife, if I'm completely honest, we're in marriage counselling, and I think I've told her before, and it was a challenge, like, you know, and we realised that charity was taking up a lot of time. So I just sat on myself. It didn't go down very well, but give me a week. And that itch or the scratch was still there. And I just said to my wife, Kelly, I said, look, you know, I can, if I set it up, ironically, I could probably control my input into it.
Delegates.
Yeah, even though that didn't happen for years because we didn't have the money. And it actually became not an albatross around the net, but it was a burden, you know. I've never got any money out of Lubbrum, never, you know. I think I had a pound in my pocket once, went straight back in the charity. But yeah, me and Tim had never made any money from it, nor did we ever want to, but we had to get to a point where we were just putting so much time into it. But again, it was great because I think we revolutionised the way charities approach things, in that we set up a charity that was for other charities, so like a brand maker that was... about the charity, of course it was. It was about the charitable giving and fundraising, what have you. But it was more of a brand piece, really. It's like a brand charity whereby we were trying to restore some civic pride in Birmingham. As you probably know, you know, us Brummies, we get on a plane and we go to Spain and someone hears our accent. Oh, right, mate, how are you? What is? And then we play this role of us being the fools.
Self-deprecation.
Birmingham's rubbish. There's a great cloud over it and all that. And I thought, you know what, actually, I think it was something, I think it was, and this is with the greatest respect to any people that are from this city, but I think Hull had beat us to like the City of Culture or something, and they were being like named in the top five, and Birmingham was, hang on, what's going on here? And I think Lubbrum was born at a time where other people were having these opinions, like I Choose Birmingham, Independent Birmingham. You started seeing all these little franchises pop up that were all beating the same chest, you know, come on Brum, let's have it. A bit like you see with that Birmingham City advertising, you know, it's all about the community, the people, like, come on, you know.
But Tim touched upon it, he's saying all the Manchester lot are shouting, Manchester, yeah. Liverpool, London, and yeah. But Brummies are kind of going,
meh,
it's all right,
yeah.
Instead of shouting about it.
Yeah, we're supporting Man United instead of Birmingham City, or dare I say Aston Villa and stuff. My wife's a Villa.
That's
not one of those. But you guys are blue noses, as am I. But yeah, so Lubbrum.
Again, self-deprecating.
Yeah, exactly, we do, don't we? We do that. And I think Lubbrum is in a way helped celebrate these brilliant people and projects that are delivering brilliant work in the city, you know, genuinely or generally rather, usually volunteer led, as Kev will know. Kev supports us, and you know, got stories to tell and doing things that, you know, they're not doing it because they've got millions in the bank, you know, they're doing it in spite of what they haven't got, if that might, or in spite of them, you know.
They did it for necessity, a lot of them as well, aren't they?
Yeah.
The knife, that we were talking about, the knife stuff and stuff that we don't necessarily, and they're not looking to kind of clack themselves about it, if that's a thing. they're just looking to get about their business and do it. And then you've seen them and you're kind of like,
yeah,
well, let's help them.
100%, man.
Let's help them tell everyone about it, because people like us who...
Yeah.
It's high on him, wasn't it?
Yeah, who don't believe in those areas.
Teenagers, like, yeah. Educating teenagers and bleed kids so they can save the friends' lives, because being stabbed that often.
If you want to go, honestly, if you ever, remember when you were a kid and you used to get, like, put the Tony Hart project on to go and have a cry because the girl's just finished with you or something? I pretend and I fed you went away. Remember that song? I'm crying inside, or whatever it was. I sometimes, when I need a bit of perspective or, you know, a little bit of a head shake, I go to Love Brum's YouTube channel, and I'm sure some of your videos will be on there now, and there's over 300 videos, all of different people from different communities, different cultures, different backgrounds, different whatever it might be, doing one thing, helping others, because of the requirement in those communities for that help, whether it be anti-bullying, knife crime, homelessness, isolation, animal welfare, education, arts, whatever. There are so many things that are falling through the cracks for a number of reasons, whether it be council cuts, whatever, yeah, apathy. And those people that are putting themselves out there, as Kev said, to do it for the right reasons, are the ones that we should be applauding all day long. And because of that, I'm hopeful that Love Brum has contributed to this sort of, like, reversal, in that we're now a bit more proud of our city, and you're seeing across all the narratives of businesses that work here, businesses that are moving here, you know, people that are coming out of the city. Alison, no one's embarrassed now to have a Birmingham accent. You was 10 years ago. I mean, my wife did a little bit of radio back in the day, and she used to go to, probably shouldn't say it, no, I think I can say this, she was giving elocution lessons to remove the accent from the narrative.
One of my questions for you was, as a proud Brummie, have you ever been pressured into having non-regional dialect coaching or
training? Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Wow. I didn't know.
Because I thought, obviously, yeah, you're in the round of broadcasting, yeah, but more recently, which we'll touch on. Yeah. But yeah, as a broadcaster, as someone that speaks to, you know, the nation through cameras, has it ever been an issue where someone said, look, we need to dial this back a little bit?
No, yeah, not to me.
I suppose for you, you've always been Brummie PJ, haven't you? That's kind of off the back of...
If anything, with the BBC opportunity I'm doing at the moment, they contacted me, not because of that. I mean, somebody put me in touch with them saying that you should talk to PJ, which was very nice of them, a guy called Kev. And when we started speaking, it was very much... it was part of their remit, the guy I was talking to, that they... Certainly the WM, BBC WM, the listeners wanted to hear more of themselves.
The Brummie of the bag.
Yeah, you know, they're driving into work, they're listening to the world being on fire or whatever, you know, they actually probably don't need even more highbrow journalism. Highbrow, that's probably the wrong word, but serious journalism. The stories that we need to hear and be told, they just want to hear themselves talking to some randoms in a wood. I know that sounds bizarre, that's where I've been this morning. But yeah, that sort of, what's the word, that vernacular, it's the sound of home, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that's something that people want us now from the Midlands to lean more into. I don't know about you guys, but you only have to turn the, you know, within a heartbeat, you're hearing Brummies more than, you know, back in our days, I suppose the radio was Northerners, weren't they? Like Manchester, yeah, London. You know, there was not much space for Brummie sounding voice. Lenny Henry, maybe, Rusty Lee.
Yeah.
But now you've got Alison Hammond, they're all over the place. Yeah, I've had no real sort of pushback around people asking me to be anything different to what I am, which helps me massively, because at last I'm feeling like I don't need to be someone that I'm not. You know, I can be a little bit naive or a little bit emotional or a little bit open. You know, I'll probably share too many things sometimes. I'm going through a bit of an ADHD journey as well at the moment. It was brilliant for me, but it was quite bizarre. I was sitting on a panel about how to grow digital marketing businesses. And this lovely lady, Amanda Perry, I mean, again, I'm elaborating here a little bit just for like the, blah, blah. But she, it was very much like the conversation was like, hello, I'm Amanda, you've got ADHD sort of thing. She saw tendencies. She's basically
Is that how she introduced herself to everyone?
That's the joke, but not so much, no.
No, okay.
She's she's been diagnosed with ADHD and she's built out a community around it. And it's, you know, I haven't been diagnosed just yet, nor would I self-diagnose myself. But I did want to explore it because the more I followed her community, I started to realise that some of the coping mechanisms around this brain, which is just like constantly on, which leads a lot into me not sleeping and a bit of anxiety and over-worry and all the stuff that I bet most people have. These coping mechanisms, you know, to slow down that brain were really helpful. And actually, although I've not medicated, because a lot of people use medicine to slow those endorphins down or whatever it might be, the science that sits in the brain that's very different to every human. I haven't done that yet, but I've definitely explored it. So I'm with the NHS at the moment and we're going through this sort of like, the direction of travel looks like I have some sort of neurodiversity. I'm still challenging myself a little bit by that old sort of approach to things, as in like, I think my old, so if I spoke to my dad, maybe my dad might be very much like, well, you shouldn't necessarily pigeonhole yourself, you know, it might just be the fact that you're overthinking a little bit, you know, like a bit more.
Yeah.
And I'm challenging, I suppose the challenge is, do I lean into this new way of looking at things and put myself in a box, for want of a better word, or do I not, and just understand that this is the way I am? So I'm looking at that just out of curiosity for now. We've all got kids, so I suppose for me as well, I want to see whether I should, how I support them if they go through those challenges, or I start seeing some sort of like, I see a lot of me in my son Blake. He's quite socially awkward, but he's very, you know, he's starting to love drama. So you want him to do a performance, he can do it, even though he's really quite shy.
As he puts on that mask.
Yeah, because he's playing someone else. And I think this is why sometimes people think I'm super confident. It's not, I turn up and play this role. But back to that conversation around me not being told or asked to be anything different, I think he's making me more relaxed and comfortable in my own skin. We didn't touch upon it that much earlier, but my name's Peter, right? Everyone knows me as PJ, yeah? And I'll tell you why if you want.
Go on.
Okay, well,
it's not, it's not Jonathan.
No, he's not. No. The middle name. This group says, hello, Jonathan. I'll do who Jonathan is. I'm your last guest.
Yeah, hi. You should have called Jonathan.
Yeah, it's not even Peter Jonathan, it's Peter James. But yeah, Peter James is. I can imagine. Marston Green Hospital, it's not there anymore.
Where were you guys?
Marston Green, yeah.
There we go. It's not there anymore. Yeah. Legends. Yeah. Marston Green legends. Have you ever seen a photograph of Marston Green Hospital? There's a photograph of me coming out. I think it was with Tom. I can't remember exactly. It's like a wood hut. It's like in the middle. Yeah, by the park. Not far from there. It's like, I mean, it might have just been an entrance, but it looked like one of those oggy blocks. Remember, like, yeah, it wasn't like the hospital's art and stuff like that.
Ring a bell, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a shed. But anyway, because I won't imagine the shed for now. I'll imagine more of a gracious, beautiful, palatial sort of like room. My mum's holding me up, obviously, Lion King-esque. Lion King-esque. Peter James Ellis. And then my auntie Janet from Tile Cross was like, oh, PJ. And it just stuck. So that's it. I've had cardigans with PJ on and everything from an early age. But it's quite weird, actually, because I think the Peter thing through school, so there's some people from school that will call me Pete. If I say hello to them, all right, Pete, and that just shakes me. But I think because my teachers would have called me Peter Ellis, yeah, yes, sir, whatever it might be. And then when I was a lawyer, even though throughout my whole application, it was always PJ, 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 my business cards were always Peter. And I'm like, I won't respond to Peter. I won't answer the phone, PJ, Peter, or won't say my name's Peter. But that's your name. And without knowing that little sort of like, that sort of ask of people for me to be someone else has really played a part in my life without me knowing.
I can't remember when I stopped calling you Pete.
You used to call me Pete. Yeah, because I probably would have introduced myself as Pete at school.
Yeah.
Because people used to call me Pete.
And then it goes, then it evolves.
And then Pete, yeah. Well, the irony is, it goes from PJ, which is an abbreviation itself. People abbreviate even further, but without me ever telling them, just call me Peach. has that been a challenge calling myself PJ? Because, you know, kids can be cruel, can't they? BJ, all that sort of stuff. And especially with the Big Brother experience. I suppose, if anything, it's made me sort of stand out a bit. PJ is a different type of name, isn't it? Not, it's not common.
Rings better than PE, doesn't it?
Sorry?
It's better than PE.
Yeah, yeah, PE. Well, I've been called P-Head a couple of times, but I don't think that's got anything to do with my initials.
I saw that.
But yeah, so no, I'm not being asked to be anything different. And that's what that's why I'm really enjoying this BBC WM stuff. You know, I'm going out talking to like genuinely lovely people from different projects, community groups, charities, businesses, whatever it might be. And although the conversations are pretty friendly and, you know, they always start with, all right, mate, or all right, bab, or whatever it might be, that's the whole thing. You start seeing how important conversations are. You know, like this stuff that you're doing now, I bet you you'll get to getting so much out of it because you're unpacking things that you don't often. You're being asked questions that you sometimes ask yourself, and then when you answer them publicly and openly, it's almost you're releasing it from your body or actually testing it. Oh yeah, actually that's probably the right answer.
It has been said it feels therapeutic, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's a great word. It is therapeutic. And I think I think if I was going to be an advocate for anything now, what I love about the BBC WM stuff is that I am an advocate almost for storytelling, telling people stories, you know, making sure people are comfortable to talk, because that's all you see now, isn't it? People on the screen, it's like, you know, it's all the other day, like, and I do it myself. I saw the other day this guy was walking his dog, most beautiful dog lover now. I've rescued a dog 4 years ago from the Birmingham Dog Zone. Changed my life, genuinely. And he was walking this dog in the most beautiful of parks, Sutton Park. You might see on LinkedIn there, I go there quite a bit. And he's on his phones. I'm like, crackers?
These dog leads now that have incorporated a phone holder.
Are you joking?
So, yeah, so...
Where'd you get it from?
No, it's all good pets at home and all good retail.
There we go, mate. There we go.
But yeah, I know exactly what you're saying there. The whole idea of walking the dog, being out in nature, letting your mind expand away from everything you deal with day to day. But you don't. You go out, you open a phone and
you do.
Stay immersed in, say, LinkedIn, business. And
I wish that, you know, I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. But I think as we were touching upon it, I think if I was going to advocate anything now, and this is me talking to myself as much as to my children and the future generation of Birmingham, is just to be more comfortable having those conversations. You know, we're seeing mental health is just like everywhere, isn't it? It's going through the roof. Like we're seeing these kids be dictated by the algorithm. You know, a poor lady who I think she responded or reacted to an Instagram post that said, "Are you lonely?" Yes. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, the algorithm's feeding her like ways to kill herself and stuff. So we live in this world. Yeah, I think that led to the Child Safety Act being changed actually around these big businesses' responsibilities around algorithm and what content be fed. But I don't care how many times you ask businesses like that, and I'm not saying I know enough to comment on it, but it's difficult to manage what people are consuming because there's just so much data and information out there. So they're being dictated by conversations that are post-truth, not real. You know, what's that saying? Comparison's the thief of all joy. So you're comparing yourself to everyone all the time. You know, he's only had that job for 2 weeks. He's got a Lamborghini. Come on. You know, it's his whatever, knackered out car, he's sprayed lime green or he's rented it or whatever. You know, we live in this weird world.
Fake it till you make it and all that jazz to a certain extent. But there's, like you say, and that goes full circle back into imposter syndrome. You just think, you see people on LinkedIn and on Facebook and it's sometimes hard to differentiate.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Fair play, they're doing well. I like that or whatever. But
you've got now as well is navigating between what's real and what's AI as well. I mean, AI explosion is all of a sudden. That's not even necessarily a real person that you're looking at. Well, there was an AI awards and they give an award to the best AI influencer and AI influencers.
Why?
So there was an awards ceremony around.
And so
the imaginary.
And AI chose who won those AI awards.
This is my
for AI.
So the irony of that is the human panel decided which AI influencer won the awards.
Yeah, I mean.
And they've got hundreds of thousands of followers. Yeah. And it's literally pictures of women, an AI generated image of a woman in a bikini on holiday, standing on the Alps, standing in Paris.
Yeah.
But this is a real thing, man. This is a genuine war settlement.
Get me on that spaceship to Mars, man.
I feel like I'm turning into my granddad.
Yeah, I thought
more and more.
And I think that's, you know, I think that will should protect our kids and those generations, because, you know, we come, you know, it comes from a place of we care. It's not like, oh, we don't want to, you know, I'm happy for advancements in all walks of life. But the AI thing scares me because I'm sure it can do some brilliant things. I mean, I just listened to a piece of news where it can start being, from a diagnostic point of view, you know, see cancer a lot earlier than before, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Tick, 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 tick. But fake people that are going to give me fake news that I think, you know, there was one, scammers now are using AI to clone people's voices. So Minnie, my daughter, for instance, they get hold of her voice or whatever, and she can get that pretty easily nowadays. And my wife might get a call and it'll be Minnie saying she's in trouble and, you know, there's some sort of exchange required. I need you to send me this money. You know, it's just, there's nasty people out there. And I think, yeah, we need to be protected in that regard. But yeah, and that just comes back to that whole point of where, you know, just put that down. That's not a phone, but you know what I mean. Put it down. And it is difficult sometimes. I'm the worst enemy sometimes. I will watch a film or a television program, football match, and at half time, the first thing I'm doing, or even if the corner's not taken as quickly, I'm turning my phone on. What am I looking for? You know, what am I waiting to see? I'm waiting to see things that are going to make me anxious. Whereas, in fact, if I just pick the phone up and spoke to my dad, or just turn to my left and spoke to my wife, I can tell you all day long which one's going to be the most beneficial. The phone? No. You know, so yeah.
It's doom scrolling, isn't it? This is, I think, from COVID especially.
Yeah.
This is what's drawn people to. This is where people are now. And it's endemic because it's created a whole generation of people sitting staring at phones.
Yeah.
From when you couldn't leave the house, so there was nothing to do elsewhere.
Mm.
And it's carried over, hasn't it? It's carried over into everyday life. Like I say, looking after and trying to safeguard children around that is it's tricky.
It is. Remember you'd put the family, YouTube or whatever, any other platform, you'd put your child-friendly tab on or whatever. And Peppa Pig, you'd still hear her swearing and, you know, talking about. So it's just so difficult to manage. And I think, you know, I'm not a parent that, you know, is perfect. Far from it. I am an iPad parent at times because this world's a busy world. And, you know, if that helps us enable us to do this, which in theory is always for them, I'll do that. You know, I'm not going to be here and preach and say that, you know, you should get your wooden toys out and play Uno every night. It doesn't happen. But I'm, you know, as I get older and I'm being more grateful for the things that I do, I suppose I'm in a position where I can just concentrate a little bit more or as much as I can on having those old school, so like your granddad, relationships that we had with our, well, I didn't have any grandparents, but grandparents and dad when we were kids, you know, real ones, just chatting, walking, play sport. That's all they want. That's the irony. They don't want the doom scroll. My son, well, he thinks he does.
Yeah.
Because he's, what is it, the endorphins or whatever, he's getting that hit. Yeah. Boom, boom, boom. But actually, the second you prize him away from it and you go to Kingsbury Water Park, it's £4 in, and you just walk, he's just a different person. And that's what they want. So, yeah, that's, you know, watch this space. I told Kelly, I'm definitely not going to set up a charity after Help Harry Help Others, set Loughborough up. 10 years later, I now am no longer officially involved with Loughborough. This is the first sort of platform I've announced that on. 2 likes. yeah, you two. Three likes. No, not because, wow, look at me. It was just, I said to Tim, I said, look, 10 years I've been doing it for. I am a big believer that there's some new blood coming through in Loughborough, a different energy. They sometimes look at me still for make the decisions. I'm not a boss. You know, I'm a dinosaur compared to some of these brilliant kids, you know, that are all there on the block. So I've walked away. I'm not a trustee anymore. I'm still involved on the WhatsApps. I'll always support it, of course. But sometimes I think you've done enough sometimes and you've just got to let other people move in. I'm not sure exactly what Tim's doing, but he's still around it. So I promised Kelly I'd never go back into a charity, but I've set another one up.
Get out.
Yeah, I have, yeah. Called For Parents From Parents. So I'm not sure when I'm going to launch it, but I've got it all set up officially as in set up as a CIC, which is a community interest company. So you can actually, you can bring, it's like, you can run it as a business really, but it's a social enterprise. So the output has to be for good. And I did it that way because I thought I might be able to create jobs at the same time. I've got no plans to make money from it. But what it is it's a platform for parents. And born out of my experience, Blake, you know, my boy, he went to a school that he didn't know anyone at, didn't know anyone, moved out of the 4X catchment area into Strigley. Excuse me, he went to a school where genuinely didn't know anyone. Going back to this, like, you know, imposter syndrome or self-awareness, whatever, he's very similar to me, very shy as a kid, and he went into a very dark place very quickly, and we had some conversations I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy, you know, about what he wanted to do and where he wanted to go, and you can only imagine what that is. I won't say, to get emotional, but I still like to think, you know what, hang on a second, I felt a real bad parent because I thought I'd let him down. I was responding to him because of the way it made me feel. So now he's flourishing and he's got friends and it's okay and he doesn't want to do the things that he told me he wants to do. Even though there's no ties in his room anymore, that's all gone. He thinks ties live downstairs because that's where ties live. Now they don't. I took all his room out. His bed that was on up on the ceiling went down to on the floor, all that. And I still live in fear that he might have some mental health issues. Like I think most kids will growing up. I didn't know where to turn. You know, you find the NHS, it's, you know, struggling. You know, I was lucky to be able to pay for private counselling, but what counselling do you want? You know, what is it? What does he need? And then when I started to talk to more parents, it was bizarre. It's like when you finish with a girl that drives a red Mini and you see red Minis everywhere. So I'm gutted, like crying every night. Yeah, please let me back. It was like that. Every parent I was speaking to had this weird, like, connection with it because they'd gone through similar situations. So one lady, you probably know her, so I won't know, well, I won't name her anyway, but she was, her daughter had issues around she was mental health. She was really struggling. And it was manifesting, or it was coming out in her. I thought, manifesting? I don't know. In OCD, sort of around cleanliness. So she was like cleaning herself from the shower that she was in. So she was in there for 3 hours sometimes. And she couldn't know where, didn't know where to go. So private counselling didn't help. Anyway, she was talking to someone about her daughter, and this lady, randomly, her daughter had been through the same thing and said, well, we tried a nutritionist in the end. And this lady got a nutritionist, what do you mean? Said, yeah, just try it. So she got advised to go and see a nutritionist. It fixed it. So I started to think, actually, there's a platform here whereby it could be a peer-to-peer community group where parents... just a talking shop, coffee, you know, it's like the board you can't afford, you know, all these networking events. Like, oh, what challenge are you having in your workforce at the moment? Could be translated very quickly into like your own private life. And then maybe building out some sort of a playbook or toolkit as to how to navigate these conversations. Because I'm lucky in the fact that when I got a bit angry, I tried the angry mode, don't be silly, you know, get on with it, you know, blah, blah, blah. To a point, even though I softened it a lot and quickly, because I spoke to Kelly and Kelly's a lot more sensitive and good at those conversations.
Diplomatic.
Yeah, we were lucky, we'd come out the other side. Some parents might not have, that might have drove my son to do things that I would never dream of him doing. So I think some toolkits as to how, I mean, this information's all out there, don't get me wrong, but I didn't have anywhere to go, like, you know, and I think it's almost like the, you know, the post office scandal, and that guy brought people together to have a similar conversation, and their journey then became more united. They had that community to talk to, and I think that's what I'd like to do. So I built the website, it's all ready to go. I'm just not pressing go on it just yet because, because I'm asleep by 2 p.m. after these early starts at BBC WM. So I've got about 10 jobs on at the moment, so... Yeah, but watch this space. I'll definitely be going again. Definitely.
Yeah. No, it's definitely a space in the market for it, isn't there? So as parents, you just kind of, very insulating job, isn't it? You do things and most of the time it feels like you're doing the wrong things.
100%. You beat yourself up there, yeah.
Yeah.
We haven't got the Bible. We haven't got, work, playbook or whatever it is, it's a challenge. And these kids are going through challenges that you and I certainly wouldn't have gone through. Kids are following them around now, WhatsApp to a point. I didn't have many fights. I couldn't fight them out of a paper bag. But
They're never off the clock, are they? All of a sudden, you're taking the bullying from school 100%. And it's coming home with you, and it's going to your room with you.
Yeah. And it's, I've only ever done this once, but I looked at my son's messages when this was all going on, and I saw the way these kids talk to one another, and it looks so aggressive. It's not, because it's just a different way they, bro. Yeah, it's very monosyllabic, isn't it? It's not like, how are you today? How's your mum? Did you have a nice walk today? It's like, yo, you come in, or it's like very aggressive. But now I know that's how they talk, I'm more comfortable with it. But there are like little nuances when I start to look at different people. To what I thought, God, this seems so aggy for a 12, 13-year-old kid. Like, to go home and be on that all night. It just feels like quite aggy.
And Claire does it. Claire goes.
Does she check?
She does, yeah. On the iPad and stuff. But might be a little bit different because Caitlin's 13 tomorrow, and she's a girl.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Different stages, haven't it?
It's, completely different. But then you can tell with her, so we've had things recently which are going to be affecting her mental health, but she'll be fine 1 minute, and I know that that's hormones, and I'll get told a lot of information that probably I don't need to know because the mom can sort that out or whatever, but I know that it's a lot of to do with hormones and age, but these conversations and these friendship groups that, it's different to when we were kids and stuff. And even going back to what you just said then, if we have a ding-dong, we'll have a fight or whatever. And I know we're lads and stuff, but even with girls, they'll have a fight and then you walk in your door and you've got the safety of your house and you can speak to your mum and dad and your brothers and sisters. This is just constant online. Can be going on till midnight when they're supposed to be in bed. And it's just never ending. And we struggle to get our heads around that, I think, a little bit as old school parents.
Yeah. They're not necessarily friend groups either, though, are they? The peer groups.
It's school,
which isn't friends. What it was like in the playground? What starts as a gentle ribbing then becomes something else, doesn't it? And then someone else will join in because they don't want to be seen.
I remember some of the kids that got it, and you think now, wow, if that was just, it wasn't nice then. But for that poor kid to have that at them all day long, you can see why they're having so many issues at the moment. I went to, I'm presenting a ball for NSPCC in October. And their main offering is child loving. Child life.
They were down the Blues, weren't they, last year?
Amanda Sinnott and Gary and that, they're down the Blues, aren't they? With Arthur, that scandal.
Yeah.
And I listened into a few calls. Not sure I should say that. I think I can because being trained to try and do some. Nah. Honestly, it was a, say it was a Tuesday afternoon. I'm bowling into an office on Haggie Road thinking they've probably got their feet up. It's probably late night, midnight, 1 o'clock. They'll get these calls. I got there early morning. They'd already had 300 calls. Yeah. Bang, 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 bang. Kids, I'm struggling with this. The good thing, I suppose, is that some of the stuff that was coming in wasn't ones that they had to respond to. It was probably like, oh, my boyfriend finished with me and I'm feeling a bit down, which is nice because they know there's an outlet there for somebody to talk to. Go back to us saying how important conversation it is. But equally, there was a couple here and there that dropped in. You're just like, wow, this is crackers. And it scares me to death thinking our kids have to go through that. Especially my mini's 8. Caitlin's 13. I know what's to come with girls. And I'm not saying, I don't know how girls are different to blokes, but only from my experience, I've been told that girls can be, it's slightly different to blokes falling out, even still now. Yeah. We've got all those challenges to come. And I just think the more we talk and the more platforms there are to allow these kids to talk, including Childline, what a brilliant, brilliant thing that is, the better.
I know I was reading the other day, the actresses from Peep Show, Big Suze and Dobbin, actresses that play them, they've set something up around the banning of the extracurricular bits on phones. So child-friendly phones to push the government to sell child-friendly, like Nokia 3310, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So it can phone, it can text, and you take all the internet and all the rest of the nonsense off it.
There's an it might be the same sort of initiative, but there was two other ladies who were journos that might have done things together, and they were going for digital detox sort of thing around, you know, no phones in school sort of thing.
Yeah,
yeah, removing that.
My daughter's, she goes to Grace.
Yeah.
And they allow phones. Yeah. Not keep it in your bag. They have phones.
Wow.
So you imagine that when you were at school as well, or whatever you've got going on. Year 7.
Wow. So you allowed your phone out, like, wow, that's crackers. Yeah.
So imagine that all through the day. So, you know, bullying, whatever else goes on there. Exactly. Send something to so-and-so at the back of the class and dig them out during the class as well.
Sure, that's what she's told you. Yeah. The school be like, Dad,
no. No, 100%. 100%.
Yeah.
She's not even that way
inclined. You see it as an abacus?
Yeah, well, I'm sure there are reasons, but equally, I think, you know, I'm touching the surface, obviously, so I don't know. You know, that seems a bit bizarre, doesn't it? You know, we're talking about potentially becoming less reliant on the phone for the things that they use the phones for. I mean, I'll phone my son. You won't pick up.
No.
Or I'd WhatsApp him. But he's on it all day.
So I'll go to pick her up at 4 o'clock after netball club or whatever. I can't get hold of her.
Yeah, she doesn't answer.
Where's your phone? It's in my blazer.
Yeah.
Why are you on silent? That's what it's for. So.
Yeah, because I finished school, Dad. I've put it on silent. What? So you have it on at school? Yeah, I think, look, we live in a different world.
Don't answer the phone name. They don't understand phonies for a voice call.
I got I don't know, probably had a few beers, and it was like, oh, Blake, you know, I'm so proud of your son. You know, thank you for being, you know, brilliant boy that you are. Blah, blah, blah. 3 days later, thumb. 3 days later, so he's seen it. Right, he has to come down and go, Dad, sorry I didn't get back to you, mate. I really appreciate that. That was so nice to you, Dad. Thank you so much. Just thumbed it. And that's the worst emoji response, isn't it? It's the worst sign. It's almost like that should mean don't do that ever again. You might as well be that, because it's not good. But like, is that the first one that comes up on my emojis? It shouldn't be that one.
For our age, you still know that's either know someone old is texting them, and you just
still meet at 10:30.
Yeah.
Now it's like
it's almost like that should be the middle finger.
Yeah, that one is so bore us.
It's
that. I'll be quite humbled by parts of my journey, and sometimes, you know, back to that Birmingham thing, I've underplayed it. I was nominated to be a baton bearer for the Commonwealth Games. I mean, the thing that I remember most about it was that I knew it had happened, so I was probably manifested it. I thought, they were like, oh, you get a uniform? Instantly, I'm thinking, they're going to be light grey trousers, aren't they? I can see my big bum. And guess what? They were light grey, like skinny, tight, fitting trousers. So instead of me thinking about the celebration I should have had to be representing Birmingham and holding this Commonwealth Games torch through my community and, you know, passing it on to another brilliant person, I was just more worried about my trousers. Ridiculous, isn't it? But I am proud of that. My family came to see me, and it was quite emotional, actually, because it was quite stressful at the time. The business I had at the time, Lightbox, was quite chaotic, because we were growing so quickly, and we were not only having to try and concentrate on building a business, we were concentrating on not counselling, but obviously managing and supporting 25 people that are all going on different journeys, their own motivations and their own challenges and stuff. I found that quite difficult. Yeah, so seeing my family applaud me, and I was but the streets were lined with people coming out, like proper. There'll be photos back in, like, you know, 300 years from now, in this geezer, like, walking. Who's he? Is that what they used to dress like, them tight trousers? Why would they wear, like, grey trousers? Weird. It's purple. You know, loving it. But that's amazing. But they sent me a replica torch. Looked on eBay, £595. Yeah,
I got five for it.
No, it's in my office. But that's a nice reminder. And I've got points of light, which is basically it's like an American MBE. Basically, it's nowhere near as, like, well, in my opinion, as highly regarded as, like, the Queen's or the King's Awards. Which brilliant people get, and I'd like to see more people get that in Birmingham. I know so many brilliant people that are doing brilliant things. But yeah, the points of light was really nice. Me and Tim won that for revolutionising charity, basically. That was probably about 8-9 years ago. But what I'm starting to see more of now is I do know without getting deep, but my kids do look up to me, and they see, you know, they hear their dad on radio. I know it sounds bizarre for us to start to think about that, but it's like, it's just PJ radio, isn't it? But they're like, wow, you know, you're on radio, that's amazing, that's so cool. So I'm trying to sort of not say, look what I've done, but try and encourage them to, you know, just be good, try and be a good person, man. Be a good person if you can, as much as you can. I've made mistakes in my life, we all have, but fundamentally, always try and be nice where I can. Try and say hello to people, make them smile, and it goes a long way. And actually, if I am lucky enough to be, you know, given these opportunities to represent your city and whatever it might be, well, then to just celebrate it a little bit. And, you know, if that enables them to think that they can go and achieve something, you know, Minnie wants to be Taylor Swift, Blake wants to be in Peaky Blinders. But you know what? Blake's already been in them blues videos. So while he's loving it.
Mm.
I think my journey so far, 44 years young, I was at a wedding on Saturday, so depending on how good you are at filtering is that, I might look a bit older than that. But, I think, what would I say? What would my advice be to anyone that's looking at life in general, business? A number of things. One, get out your own way as quick as you can. If you haven't watched, Ted Lasso? You watched Ted Lasso?
Yeah.
If you haven't watched Ted Lasso, watch Ted Lasso. That would be one something I'd say. Get out your own way, believe, all that sort of stuff. It's really important. Because no one cares as much about you than you think they do. That's a big thing for me. If you get one like on a LinkedIn post, or one person liked it, how cool is that? Someone got something out of it. It's probably your dad or your mom or something, but hey-ho. And then just lean into these opportunities. I would say there's no right or wrong answering whether you say yes lots or no lots, but instead of that advice that I would have given before, say no more, which I should have done because I've said yes a lot, I think it should be more of a spin on just say yes positively. As in, like, just take your time a little bit. If you've got an opportunity and you think it's a yes, say yes and jump into it. Don't do it and then be gutted you've said yes. You know, just say yes positively. Dive into it. Be grateful for the opportunities and just enjoy them. Just like today. You know, it's a nice little chat. I've got so much out of this. I think you did a great job. I think, you know, just having... You know, just to listen to the other people that have been on your podcast, to listen to their experiences is helpful. And I'm seeing more people will know about certified pro installs, which is nice as well. So yeah, keep doing it. I mean, you're on episode 8 already. That's amazing. That's class.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
No views.
I'll get you a couple. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
No, but you know what? It's I think things like this are... you know, there's been no phones. Obviously, there's technology, of course, there is. But we've had a good old chat. You could probably have chatted for a lot longer.
Yeah.
And then I think hopefully everyone, whether they'd be watching it, you across that table, me across this table, got something out of it. I think that just shows how important conversations are. So I'm really grateful for you having me on, lads. Thanks,
appreciate you coming on. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for your time.
Cheers.
Cheers, mate.
See you later.